Hi everyone, big news. We've been nominated for a British Podcast Award in the lifestyle category. So thank you so much for all your support so far. And we're really proud of ourselves because we have been going for just 1 year. We're absolutely chuffed, but there's one more thing. There is a Listener's Choice Awards and it's now open. And you get to vote for the podcast you love listening to. And if you can vote for us, we'd really, really appreciate it. So if you go to www.britishpodcastawards.com/voting and vote for This Is Powerful with Paul Scorful. It's open till the 8th of September. Your voting means a lot to us. Thank you for your support. We're really excited to be in the running for this.
I think half of the stuff that's happened in my life, so the pre-recovery section, then there was my first decade of recovery. Then the second decade of recovery was having my son, who, as you know, has got, you know, very complex disabilities and all that that's brought. Most of the time now, I can look on all of these things as they are not things that I would have chosen, you know, but they are gifts. You know, that doesn't mean that there are many, many, many days where I'm like, fuck, it's so hard, you know, suffering and mental health stuff and, you know, pain and fear about my son. Like, it's fucking hard. And it's okay that it's hard.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scorful. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today, I have an amazing guest, Ebony Gilbert. She's a birth doula, a poet from East London, and a special needs mum to her son, George, who has complex disabilities. She has 18 years of continuous sobriety and has navigated a long-term relationship with her partner, who is also in recovery with 21 years sobriety. Ebony was spotted by a top fashion model agency, Select, at the age of 13, and went on to work as a glamour model and then embarked on an acting career. Whilst Ebony might have had an amazing career on the outside, she was quietly battling an eating disorder and addictions to drugs and alcohol. She gets into a bit of genetics and hereditary ancestral trauma, the healing power of asking for help, and her effective daily calming techniques. Ebony, thank you so much for coming on. This Is Powerful.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's weird to see you because I haven't seen you for how long? 20 years?
I haven't seen you for about 20 years, yeah.
How long have you been in sobriety?
So I've been sober and clean for 18 years.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm. But I came in just over 20 years ago. So I had a couple of years of, you know, kind of being a bit in and out and
testing
up and down.
Testing if it works or
yeah.
Not.
Turns out I definitely need to be here. Yeah. I always say it's a bit like me drinking or using is like putting petrol on a bonfire. It's generally not a very good idea.
Yes, there's a big display going on of some sort. Or a hot mess, maybe.
Hot mess. Not so hot anymore, just a mess. Great.
18 years sober, it's a big, big achievement.
Yeah, and I can't quite believe it. Sometimes I'll have a dream about drinking. And I think in the dream, it's always that, oh no, you have been drinking all along, just here and there. And when people say to me like, what, you've not had one drink in 18 years? And I go, well no, because if I'd have had one, like I wouldn't have had one, would
it,
I?
It, yeah, and it wouldn't be 18 years.
No, exactly. You'd know about it. But yeah, it's quite shocking to me. It's like living two very different lives. Is the before sobriety and there's after sobriety. And I can't quite believe it's been that long.
When you look back on yourself, can you recognise how you were? Or does it feel like a different person?
It's a good question. And as soon as you asked that, it made me feel just a little bit emotional, because I kind of know that, like, that was the essence of me.
Hmm.
But the me that was very, very distorted by, you know, all of the, not just the addiction itself, but all the stuff that's underneath that, the shame, the fear, the, you know, the loneliness, the pride, all of that stuff that, you know, was kind of acquired. You know, you're not born with that stuff, you acquire it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, recovery is, I guess, you know, I don't know, the unacquiring of it, or the kind of balancing of it. But I look back and I think these days I feel a huge amount of compassion for that young part of me, most of the time. But for many, many years, it was just pure shame. It was pure shame. I wanted to kind of cut that part of me off and completely dissociate from it. Whereas I think now it's, you know, people talk about inner child work, for example. And when I think of an inner child, yes, I'm thinking about, you know, perhaps a 5-year-old or a 9-year-old, but there's also, you know, the 20-year-old who was, you know, falling down and just really, really struggling. And yeah, it's all of those parts. It's kind of, you know, integrating all of those parts and showing them all love and compassion and giving them all a voice, really, to say, this is how it was for me then.
Yeah, that's really amazingly put. Mm. I feel like it's like a Hoover if you're an addict. You just, if you've got a dusty carpet and you're just hoovering along, you're going to pick everything up as you go along: shame, guilt, the horrors, hiding things, the pain, the embarrassment, the thinking you're a legend. You know, all of that stuff just comes along as a package deal, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that thing of I'm shit and I'm it.
I've never heard that. Say that again.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm shit and I'm it.
That's amazing.
Like, I'm better than them. I'm not as good as them.
Yeah.
Like, I am not enough, or like, free, you know, like, I'm too good for this. You know,
yeah, it's nothing in between.
Nothing in between. Who does in between? I don't get it.
Wow. That's
still, right. Sorry, but still, yeah.
Oh, I bet you do. You know, you've had an amazing career as a model and now a poet. You've published books. And you've been an actress. I didn't know how much stuff you did.
Yeah, so I had a kind of brief career as an actress. I think the modelling, I started that young. So I was 13 when I started that.
How did that all start?
So I was 13 and I was in a shopping centre and I was spotted by a fashion agency called Select, which I know you were also with.
Yeah.
And I wasn't very tall, and they were like, let's see how this goes. You know, she could grow a little bit more. I'm still not very tall, by the way. I'm 5'3", just in case
you can't
see. Are
you still on their books until you get to 6 foot?
They were like, when she's 6 foot, she's going to earn us a fortune, but for now, nah. So I started doing all the kind of teen magazines and, you know, like, kind of clothing campaigns and stuff. So that was kind of age 13.
Were your parents okay with that? Because that's young.
Yes. So my mum used to accompany me to London all the time for kind of castings and jobs. And then when I was about maybe 15, 16, it became apparent that I didn't grow any taller. And so I was kind of booted out.
How was that? That's quite
I'm laughing about it. It wasn't great. You know,
16, if you've had a 3-year career so far and you get kicked out, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, and, you know, I know for me that, you know, I'm not saying that this was the cause of it, but starting that at age 13, that's when bulimia for me started as well. And that kind of, you know, feeling that need to look good and fit in and all that stuff. And so, yeah, so age sort of must have been 15, 16, that all kind of came to an end. And then when I was 17 and my drinking started to really take off, I decided I was going to move to London by myself and I was going to be a pastry model. I was like, that's what I'm going to do. Yeah, I'm going to have a completely, just going to go to London on the train, leave college, don't know anyone, and move here. And so I did that. I moved into that.
What was you studying in college?
I was doing media studies, English literature, and theatre studies.
Oh.
Yeah. So I did about a year and then I was like, nah.
What college did you go to?
It was in Nottingham. It was Clarendon College, yeah.
Nice. You said you started drinking then and you had bulimia before.
Mm.
Did you have any issues prior to the modelling?
You know, with the more kind of fashion side of things, obviously, you know, it's a kind of slimmer aesthetic, a flatter chest. And then suddenly I came to London at 17 and was like, I'm going to be a glamour model, you know. And was told point blank, you need to get a boob job if you're going to do this. You know, you need to eat fruit for a few days and then come back, get a boob job. And I was, literally, that is what they said to me. Like, wow. As a 17-year-old kid.
What college did you go to?
It was in Nottingham. It was Clarendon College. Yeah.
Nice. You said you started drinking then and you had bulimia before. Mm. Did you have any issues prior to the modelling?
You know, with the more kind of fashion side of things, obviously, you know, it's a kind of slimmer aesthetic, a flatter chest. And then suddenly I came to London at 17 and was like, I'm going to be a glamour model, you know, and was told point blank, you need to get a boob job if you're going to do this. You know, you need to eat fruit for a few days and then come back, get a boob job. And I literally, that is what they said to me, like, wow. As a 17-year-old kid, you know. Wow. And so I did. I did that. And then again, when I then ended the modelling after maybe 3 or 4 years or so and started the acting career, it was like, oh, you look a bit too modelly. You know, your hair's a bit too blonde, your boobs are a bit too big. And I was like, yeah. Right, you know, and then I had them taken out.
Did you?
Well, I had them taken out maybe 6 years ago, just for myself, really. Yeah. But it, you know, it was like, you're too this, you're too that. And I had enough of that inside my own brain. You know, it's that low self-worth. And then that's perpetuated by being in that kind of environment and that industry.
More than you can ever know. And I know I used to get annoyed when people would say, probably at the height of my career, oh, it's all right for you because you've got lots of money and you're a model and you can get any girl you want to. Mm. And no one understands. They always see the end result like a movie. You see everyone on the red carpet and you think, wow, I'd love that job. And you don't see the 3 years of preparation, all the, you know, the work you do behind the scenes and et cetera.
Yeah.
And I think people don't know that about modelling, whether it's glamour modelling or normal modelling, that there's that constant talk.
Mm.
Like I had the same inside, and that was compounded by everyone else telling me their own opinion.
Exactly. And being, you know, you're literally being paid to look a certain way, and people are, you know, like either liking you or hating you for looking a certain way.
Yeah.
So everything becomes about image, you know, and I can't say that that's really left me. That's one thing that I think maybe one day my self-worth will be at a place where I just don't really care anymore.
How did the bulimia, did it get you strongly early on?
Yes. So it started at age 13 and it went on until I was 22. So when I came into recovery, actually the first sort of recovery fellowship I ever went to was for food issues.
Yeah.
The only reason I'd learnt about that was because I'd read it in somebody's autobiography, someone who I really admired. And I'd been to, you know, one meeting, left there and couldn't handle it, binged on food, threw up, went out. I was like, no, that's not for me. You know,
too close to home.
Yeah, and then it was a good few years later that I came into recovery, thank God.
I love what you said that from someone's biography, because, you know, part of our podcast is to educate people to also break stigma.
Yeah, it's a tricky subject because obviously, you know, there's a lot of talk about anonymity and how that can impact and affect people. But, you know, for me, it's only a helpful thing. I think, you know, even just me putting my sobriety anniversary on whatever, Instagram or Facebook, I don't really want or need to put that on for me.
Mm.
But I just think, well, somebody might see it who thinks, oh, well, they're all right. And they seem to, you know, they've come through it kind of thing. Like they've been where I've been.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, I have a handful of people over the years who have seen that and have contacted me and are now in recovery. And I'm like, that is, you know, passing on the message, you know, and I think, you know, it's raising awareness and it's, you know, sharing knowledge. And if people don't know that it's there, you know, and a lot of people aren't really aware of it, or they think, oh, that's just for those kind of people or those kind of people. And it's like, oh, what? You're one of those kind of people. And I'm like, I am.
Definitely have been.
Oh, yeah, definitely have been.
Was your family aware of the bulimia?
Yes, they were later on. Yeah. So obviously it's, you know, generally a very kind of secretive thing that, you know, that was found out, and, you know, they tried to address it, you know, took me to the doctors and, you know, but really, you know, it's not, I think one chat with a GP is not really, and it took me wanting to change and me being ready for that to change. And, it seems kind of quite alien and foreign to me talking about bulimia because it's so long ago and it feels like, oh, wow, that is just, you know, drink, drugs, throwing up, none of it occurs to me anymore. And it's so it feels kind of strange to be talking about it. But for me, the way that I always went, once I came into recovery, I understood that it wasn't really all about weight and appearance. It was about having uncomfortable feelings, which I wasn't even aware of at that time, and the food going in and it being kind of like a sponge that absorbed the feelings and then getting rid of it. And the same with anything, the same with, you know, kind of if I think about alcohol, it's kind of like burning away the feelings, you know, cigarettes, burning away, smoke a fag, smoke a feeling, you know, that it's a way to manage overwhelming feelings that feel unbearable and intolerable. And yeah, it was very effective and it's probably saved my life for a great many years, all of those addictions. You know, I need to kind of be grateful for them that, you know, they were the defences that kept me alive.
It's a very, very clear way of saying it because we're doing school talks for our foundation as well.
Mm.
That's a really good thing. I might have to take that because,
yeah, I do.
Because people don't understand the feelings, myself included, a long time ago.
Yeah.
And you try to wrap them up in something or try and get rid of them because they're overwhelming.
Yeah. And honestly, I didn't really understand feelings until I came into recovery. I went into a treatment centre for a month and they put up on the board, you know, like anxiety and sadness. And I was like, what do you mean? I don't really get what you mean. I honestly was like flummoxed by it. And when I put down the drink and the drugs and everything else, I was like, oh, I know what you mean now. Like I'm crippled by all of these things on a daily basis. But I didn't know that that's what I was doing. I just like to party and I just like to be thin. I don't want to, you know, I honestly had no idea that drinking and using was A, escaping from feelings and trying to, you know, repress and control them, but also giving me that counter, like artificial counter to the shame and the fear of like, I can chat, I can turn up and I can be like outgoing and, you know, fun and not crippled by anxiety and standing in the corner like shaking and shy. There's nothing to take the edge off it other than, you know, maybe, yeah, a coffee, your phone, your cigarette. Yeah, you know, we all use things to manage our feelings day to day. And what I try and do now is not to berate myself for, I don't know, say if I shut down or, you know, I fall asleep or I'm picking my skin or I'm, you know, having a cigarette and a coffee or whatever it is. I'm like, it's all right. I'm doing all the other stuff, right? I'm doing reading, writing, prayer, meditation. I'm doing phone calls. I'm doing gratitude lists, right? It's okay. You don't have to be a saint. You don't have to be perfect. And sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly on all of these things, you know, the drink, drugs, bulimia, they had instant catastrophic repercussions, whereas this stuff is more subtle and it takes time, you know, in recovery. It takes time working through your past and learning about yourself and finding new ways to take care of yourself. And for me, those things were taking care of myself. You know, I can look at that most days now as an act of like self-love. Like I was doing anything I could to survive and keep myself okay.
Self-preservation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think about that. I in the 90s, for example, I was definitely, I thought I was in my flow because I was quite cocky and I was confident. And I think I built up a persona because reality was I wasn't.
Mm.
And I was very insecure, very nervous. You know, I traveled every week. Met different people, which again was an amazing experience. But someone who's shy and gets drained with being around a lot of people, that was tough. So I was working all the time on myself and that. And drinking drugs mastered it. It allowed me to do what I needed to do to get around until it stopped working.
Mm.
So that's not telling anyone that they should do that because it works, but it definitely got me somewhere, but then took everything away that it gave me. How did you get to go into rehab? Because was that before the 2 years or was that after the 2 years of trying to...
That was after. Yeah, that was about maybe a year and a half in. Maybe a year in. I'm not sure, actually. I started seeing a therapist who was fantastic. And she said, I don't think it would be wise for us to start looking at this kind of heavy trauma stuff until you've got a little bit more sobriety under your belt. And she talked about treatment. And at that time, I was like, I don't have money for that. That's not an option. And she randomly had heard that one of the treatment centres needed to fill a couple of spaces and that I could go for whatever it was, 500 wow. quid. And I was like, wow. And it was like, you know, in 3 days' time, I was like, oh, okay. So I went and I came out and I continued to go to meetings for a while and then I picked up again. And so I had about 60 days and that pattern went on for a while. It was 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 4 months. You know, then it was every weekend, like picking up, relapsing every weekend.
Did when you come out though, when you was in treatment, did you really kind of get a chance to look at yourself? Because it takes a time to land when you go into treatment, doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you know, I wasn't ready. I was absolutely not ready. And I wasn't ready for quite a few years in recovery to go there with that stuff. And, you know, once I finally, you know, got sober and managed to stay sober, and nothing dramatic happened the last time I drank, really, you know, compared to some of the other stuff. It was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
And I had met, right then, I had met my partner, who I'm still with now, in recovery. He's 21 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I had picked up again, and he had ended the relationship. And I was gutted. And he had just said, you know, I want this for you. Like, I want you to go and find, you know, go and find what you need to find. And it's too painful for me to see you like this.
That was good of him.
Yeah. And then something just changed. And I stayed sober, not for him, not for my mum, not for anyone. Like, just something changed. I think treatment was helpful. But more than anything, just that kind of daily, like weaving recovery into my daily life, you know, being in the real world with it, like a bridge to normal living, that was important for me, and still is.
How did you manage doing the movies? Were you sober through that whole period? Or
I was, yeah.
Wow, that
yeah,
was
so
cool.
I started at acting school, which is where we met,
yeah,
when I was still drinking. And I'm sure you don't mind me saying, it was you that introduced me to recovery, you know. So meeting through the acting school and it absolutely changing my life, you know. So, yeah, the little bit of success that I had with the films and TV stuff was all done sober. And it was a whole new level of anxiety because I just used to turn up to things and I was like, yeah, whatever, I don't care. Like, great, I'm really confident, like, whatever. Like, you know, I could chat to anyone and yeah, I was not scared of anything, apparently. And then all of a sudden, I remember going to, it was a callback for The Firm, which was Nick Love's film. And the casting director being like, whatever you need to do to just get rid of this anxiety before you go in for the final callback, just do it. And I was just like, ugh, because I was shaking and I was like, I'm just,
wow,
you know.
How did you take that?
Found it really difficult. I was like, yeah, I'm like an open book. You can see when I'm nervous. So I just end up saying, I'm really nervous, by the way. Like, I'm not going to be able to just cover it up and be like, yeah, I'm cool. Yeah. I'm like, nah, that doesn't work. So yeah, it was interesting being in that kind of industry. Being
what did
sober.
You do in that situation? Because I suffered from bad anxiety as well.
Yeah. I probably did the opposite and drank loads of coffee, smoked loads of cigarettes, and took beta blockers, which is what I was prescribed. You know, I was like, I don't know what to do. I've been prescribed it. So just take that. And, you know, and I was on those for a very, very long time. It was actually when I got sober, it was then I started being, you know, kind of prescribed medication for, you know, all kinds of like anxiety and depression and stuff that I wasn't aware of at all before. And I have to say, I'm a big advocate for people seeking that help if and when they need it, because yeah, I think, you know, some people do need it and they need it to stay alive. And
there's no point being a hero if you need the stuff you need to have.
No, exactly. And some people do need a bit of extra support, and not necessarily forever. Some forever, yes, but others, they need that stability to be able to then you know, progress and change and look at certain things. So it's something that I'm always very open about and has saved my life.
How old was you when you took your first drink?
I was about 13 when I discovered, what's this? This is good. It all kind of started at the same time, like drink, drugs, boys, you know, bulimia, all of it, all around the age of 13. And obviously at that point in your life, it's much harder to access it because, you know, you're still a kid. But the effects were immediate, you know, immediate kind of like elation, blackout, like chaos. And then it was when I moved to London when I was kind of 17-ish that things really took off because I had no one to be accountable to. It was just me. And
how were your parents with I'm going to London on my own and just getting a place? And
probably really not very happy about it. But, you know, also I was like, Dad, you know, you paid for that private girl's education, but I'm going to London to be a glamour model. And he was like, fucking brilliant. Just what we hoped you'd do with that. Excellent. I know that my mum was really supportive. She came down and would like help me, like, this is how you clean a bin and this is how you do this. And but, you know, I was very, very lonely when I moved here. I didn't know anyone. I was very lonely and kind of started the modeling, got on that scene, and very quickly, you know, by the age of 18, that's when, you know, the drugs came in. And I mean, I'd taken things before, like when I was younger, like, you know, the stuff that kids take, speed and all that kind of stuff. But
how was the success though? Because you were really successful in a short period of time, right, in the glamour modeling stuff?
Yes. So it kind of went from nothing to being on the front page of the tabloids and on page three, obviously. But
That? Because it's a big thing if someone hasn't experienced it. You've done the modelling, then you got kicked out, and then now you've reinvented yourself, come back again.
Yeah, and it, you know, back then it was. It's really interesting because even a few years ago, Paul, I would not have wanted to speak about. I would say, don't mention pastry or glamour modelling because I was ashamed of it. I was like, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want people to think that's who I am, what I am. Mm. And now I'm like, no, talk about it. Like, talk about it. It's part of me. It's part of my past. And it's one of those me's that was, I realise now, who is actually very anxious about, you know, and prudy, you know, I'm quite prudy and I'm like, oh no, don't say nipple. Oh my God. Like, you know, and I'm putting myself in that environment where, you know, to be kind of looked at and seen in a certain way and yeah. And people recognizing you and, you know, being in gossip columns and, you know, dating people and then all the shit that comes with that, which, you know, yes, was very exciting and, you know, everything was free, drink, drugs, you know, pay you to come to parties, bring all your model friends kind of thing. It was exciting. It was fun. And then I heard this in recovery once. Someone said, you know, first it was fun, then it was fun with problems, and then it was just problems.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it was. And also, I could just go, fucking hell, that's cool that I did that. That's really cool that I went to the Playboy Mansion and like, all that stuff is like, yeah, that's cool. Like, it's all right. You know, I don't need to like hide in shame and go, oh my God, what would my doula clients think that I'm not a proper feminist because I used to be a pastry model? And I've got a Playboy tattoo on my ass. That's right. It's still there. And I've toyed with covering it up and changing it. And every time I go to do it, I'm like, no, it's part of who I was.
Sitting here looking at you, it's incredible because to have that journey, like what you said, and do what you do now, it seems to be like a full person. You know, you've experienced glamour to go to the mansion in, you know, in California and stuff. I mean, not many people get to do that and then do something, a doula.
Yeah,
a doula. Which I never actually knew.
Paul's
that.
Paul's like, you're so a dealer. And I was like, I'm a dealer now.
A doula with a foreign accent. It's incredible, isn't it? And I just think that's amazing because it just, for me, it's like, it's just... it's like a flower bed with different types of flowers. It's just a flourishing place instead of one crop. You know, it's like so much experience in life.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've had a few lives. I've packed it in, you know, I've packed them in. Also because I tend to flip from one thing to another, you know, I'm like, all right, I've done poetry, I'm done with that now, I'm bored. And then people are like, will you come on our poetry podcast? And I'm like, nah, I don't do that anymore. Like, you know, it was a 3-year like obsession.
Yeah.
And then I'm kind of done with it. But my doula work I've been doing for 12 years now. It's my, you know, it's my career. It pays the bills. I fucking love it. It is such
How did you get into it? I honestly feel really silly because I never knew what a doula was.
So a doula is, think of it as almost like a professional birth partner. So you are there not for the medical capacity, but my job would entail, you know, advocacy for the client, letting them know what their rights are in within the NHS or the private setting, emotional, physical and practical support. So it could be anything from massage to acupressure to, you know, biomechanical birth positions to breathing techniques to tapping to anything that helps them to regulate their nervous system so that in birth, their oxytocin hormone, which is the hormone of birth, can be as high as possible and their adrenaline can be as low as possible. Because wow. It's kind of all comes down to hormones, and it all comes down to the woman feeling safe in her space and feeling like she's got choice, feeling like she's supported and feeling like everything is her decision. So it's a very, I'm there for, you know, the antenatal, like the pregnancy prep, you know, I get to know them very well. It's a lot of education around labor and birth. And then I'm on call for 4 weeks and then I join them when they're in labor and I stay until a couple of hours after the baby's born. So
wow.
It's a very intense job. It's very intimate. It can be dramatic. And it lights me up. It's just, I can't believe that I found a job that is just so me. Yeah. And that I also get to just be myself. I don't have to, because I was originally training to be a midwife. So I started the training for that and ended up becoming a doula, which, you know, is different. A midwife is there for the medical aspects. They also have to stick within very rigid guidelines, which they might not necessarily agree with or think is best for this woman and baby. So I get to kind of go, you know, here are your options. Here are the benefits, the risks, the alternatives. What does your instinct tell you? Give them the evidence, give them the statistics, and then support them in whatever their choices are. Even if I don't agree with it, it doesn't matter. It's not my birth.
That's amazing.
I love it. Absolutely love
Why
it.
Why do you love it? What is it, do you think, that everything that you've taken from your life up to now, that's your thing?
Originally, you know, I even say on my doula profile, like, call me codependent, but I just love looking after people, like, you know, whatever. I like tucking you in. I'll look after you. I'll massage you. Like, let me look after you. Not that I'm infantilizing you at all, because that's a big thing now. But, you know, just to go, I'm here, I hear you, like, I hear you, it's okay. You know, you can cry, you can be scared, it's okay. Because, you know, the things that we have lacked ourselves, perhaps, you know, that thing of feeling like when I was in my most difficult moment, I didn't feel there was anyone there for me. And so that's where the desire for it originally came from. But now I realize, like, I'm not there to prevent trauma. I'm there to hold their hand through something that, yes, potentially could be traumatic for some. Hopefully it's not, but I'm there to hold their hand through it so they know that they're not alone in it. And it's, you know, I get to meet so many wonderful people and be part of such a intimate part of their lives. Yeah. I mean, I'll come back from a birth and I'll say to Steve, oh yeah, I've just been dancing with this naked woman all night. Like, you know, she's kind of, you know, oh, her water's popped all over me, or like she threw up on me, and I just fucking love it. Like, it's so real. It's just life. It's real people, and they are in their most primal, vulnerable, raw state, and I fucking love that. You know, I'm not one for top show and chit chat, and I don't really get small talk. I'm like, give me the core of it. Like, I love it. It's amazing.
Do you think that your capacity for drama and intense situations and all that helped because of your addiction?
Yes.
Addictions.
Yeah. Yeah. Funnily enough, my doula partner, so we do shared care as well. She said recently, she went, oh man, I need a birth. And I went, you sound like such an she's like, I'm a birth junkie. She's like, I haven't had one for ages. You know, you get called in the middle of the night, usually. You know, it might be 2 a.m. Can you come now? Da, da, da. And it's a bit of a high, you know, and then you get in the room. And usually it's really long and really boring. You're there for like, whatever, 24 hours. You know, you're in that with them.
And you stay up with them through the whole thing?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. What happens to the partner or the husband?
So it's about me supporting both of them. So it's not about a doula doesn't take the partner's place. It's like we swap skills. So let's say, you know, you and your wife, for example, I might say, look, you know her and I know birth, so we can work together in this. So maybe she's in labour, she's feeling stressed and anxious. Maybe my instinct is to go and, you know, give her a hug and reassure her. And you go, actually, you know, when she's really overwhelmed, she just needs a bit of space. Yeah. I'm like, great. And then I might say to you, just do some counter pressure on the lower back during the surges while I chat to the midwife or get the birth pool ready. So we're kind of, we're working as a team. And sometimes it's often with the dads, it's just me giving them a little thumbs up and a reassurance that everything's fine. You know, yeah. If there's blood or if there's, I don't know, somebody rushes into the room to look at the monitor of the baby's heartbeat. It's just to go, this is okay, you know, it's okay. And to explain to them in a calm way what's happening. While the medics are doing the medical stuff, I'm there for the emotional support. And just, and I always say to them, if I'm doing this, like putting my thumbs up and smiling, it's all good.
Would you go back to doing any acting or anything like that if you was asked?
No. I have been asked and I was like, nah, it's not for me.
Yeah.
I've thought about it a couple of times and sometimes I see really good acting and I think, oh man, I feel a bit of grief in my heart because I'm like,
yeah.
I loved it. I loved the craft of it so much, but the actual experience of the industry, it was not for me, not as a sober person. It's just not for me. And I think, you know, when you're acutely sensitive, as I know you are, I know for myself, it can really easily tip my head off balance being in that kind of environment. And I can do it, but I need to do a lot of work before and after to manage that. And I just don't really want to. It's just not for me. It kind of taps into lots of things that don't feel great for me. And yeah, you're right. You know, that thing of being around lots of people and that just having those opportunities to just be quiet, be alone, ground your energy, get back into your body and being in the presence of, you know, I can be as you probably know, a bit of a chatterbox. I've got a high energy, apart from when I haven't, when I'm like, I'm either on or I'm off. There's nothing in between. And I always say to people, I promise I'm quiet when we're actually at the birth. You know, because I go, ba-da-da-da-da-da, and they're like, oh, we love all the knowledge and the information. Getting in the presence of someone else who is, you know, calm and grounded, it kind of has that, what's the word? Almost by osmosis sometimes. Yeah. You can kind of go, ah. Oh, I can let go. Quite often in a birth, for example, rather than me saying breathe or like, you know, drop your shoulders, da, 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 they'll look at me and I'll go and I'll breathe and I'll drop my shoulders. And then they go, you know, and then the midwife does it. And it's like, okay, the tension in the room has just gone down a notch, you know.
Was it difficult to learn all those skills? Because if someone's working their own program in recovery, you really get to, well, I can only speak for me, to really learn how to centre, because it's important. Because I can be like 100 miles an hour and sometimes I try and go to 200 because I just like the feeling.
Yeah.
But then I know I'm like, hang on a minute, you're going a bit too fast here. How do you slow down? How did you learn that whole process in recovery?
I think my quest for kind of, I'm a complete research geek and I love learning only about things that I'm interested in, though. Like, if I'm not interested, I'm like, nah, like, you can't even drag me to learn that. No, I'm not interested. But most of the stuff that I use in my birth support is all about, it's all about nervous system regulation. And it's because I have had and continue to have often so much trouble with my own nervous system, that constant living in fight, flight, fawn, freeze all the time. Even in, you know, many, many years into recovery. And, you know, I've done a lot of work around it and I still need to do a lot of work around it on a daily basis because my initial reaction is to, you know, like go full throttle. And the urgency of like rushing from one thing to the next and the, yeah, that kind of addictive tendency to just keep going. And actually learning a lot of the stuff that I've learned it for me as well as my clients. And I'm great at doing it for other people. Like, I find it more tricky with myself. But, you know, most days I use all of those techniques, whether it's, yeah, like acupressure or like we were talking about tapping. And
did you train in EFT?
I didn't do any training in EFT. I've done it probably every day for maybe 7 or 8 years mostly. Wow. And it's a big part. I was doing it on the way here in the car because I was feeling anxious about doing the podcast, you know, and I was like, you know, just tapping through the points. And it's just, it's a really innate kind of part of my life and recovery. I don't really think, oh, I'm going to do some tapping now. I just find myself tapping the points as I go through my day.
What do you think addiction is? Because do you think you're born with it?
Yes. I also think that some of that is sometimes quite kind of spectrum related, whether that's, you know, ADHD or autism spectrum.
Do you have ADHD?
Yes. I was diagnosed with it about 3 years ago.
Why did you go then?
Why did I go then?
Yeah.
I honestly never had a clue about anything to do with ADHD. And I read a book by a woman who has ADHD. And as I was reading this book, I thought, God, she's got the same brain as me. Like, I've never heard anyone who's described the inside of my head. You know, I look like an old person who goes to work and functions, and I'm just like, you have fucking no idea what's going on in here, mate. And towards the end of the book, she talks about having an ADHD diagnosis and started me looking into it. I went along. Suddenly everything made sense to me. I was like, oh, right, okay. You know, it's not that I'm broken and I'm too traumatized and I can't, you know, my brain is wired differently, whether I was born that way or whether it was acquired, because I do think, you know, there is a genetic proponent to it, absolutely, with autism and ADHD, but there's also that acquiring of it through, you know, various external factors, whether that be emotional trauma, whether it be, you know, a reaction to a virus even, you know, there are certain things that can be, for a very sensitive immune system, the final insult on their body. It's not saying that caused it. It's like, you know, their system was struggling anyway. You know, there's also so many people have this kind of MTHFR gene as well, which is particularly people in recovery from alcoholism, where they just don't methylate in the same way that other people do, which means they don't let go of toxins in the same way. So when they do drink, they get like, it accumulates in the system. It gives them a bigger high. Yeah. The body doesn't let go of it in the same way. And that's also, interestingly for me, is also comorbid with ADHD and autism, you know, that having that gene. So my son, for example, who is profoundly autistic, you know, it turns out me and my partner both have this MTHFR gene. So he has a double copy of it, you know, which means, he, you know, he think he's hypersensitive to everything, as am I. So your original question, you were asking about, do we think we're born with addiction?
Yeah.
I think this is really tricky, and I have gone back and forth on it many, many times. I think that there is most definitely genetics at play. But when you look at things like epigenetics, so, you know, somebody's born with a switch for, let's say, addiction, alcoholism, schizophrenia, whatever that thing is, and it takes a certain environment and a certain set of circumstances to activate and switch on that gene. So that's where epigenetics comes in. So, for example, I might have the Alzheimer's gene, right? And it never materializes in my life. Or I go down a certain path, which is, you know, my health's not great, you know, lots of trauma, whatever that is. And that gene just gets flicked on for whatever reason. So there's that, you know, like I have two brothers. One of them passed away a few years ago, and he was schizophrenic. And I'm like, yeah, you know, maybe I have that gene as well. And maybe under a certain set of circumstances, that may have been activated in me. And thankfully, it hasn't been, you know, probably thanks to recovery, I'm pretty sure. But it's difficult because there's that whole thing of, like, you know, the kind of, what's the word for it? Kind of the, I don't want to say like ancestral trauma, but the things that get passed down from generation to generation to generation. You know, if my mother's 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 mother was, I don't know, sexually abused, or, you know, your dad's 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 dad went through genocide, that then impacts their nervous system, their physiology, and their behavior and their emotional capacity, so that their children are going to have a different kind of parenting and a different biology and a different chemical makeup. And that gets passed down and passed down and passed down. And it doesn't get better. It tends to get worse, you know, until someone kind of breaks it and goes, oh, I'm too broken. I need to stop. Like, I need to do something about this. You know, and quite often that's the one who goes into recovery. So I can look at my dad's side of the family and think, well, there's loads of addiction there. So I'm probably, you know, genetically an addict, alcoholic, whatever you want to call it. But I also see that there was a lot of control, you know, in the parenting from his parents. And so, you know, that control on the five kids has had a huge impact on them and the way that they deal with their feelings and their control and the way that they need to soothe themselves. So I haven't really given you an answer. I'm not, it's a bit of both, I think.
I think that was really good, actually, what you said, because what's really important, what I've learned in recovery, is someone said to me that you can change the genealogy 7 generations ago. So if someone had trauma back then and it's passed down, you can stop it.
Yeah.
So that's what I feel about recovery. Hopefully, I think I got the brunt of it all. And what's nice though is that not to blame anybody or not to use it as a crutch. Oh, well, if you had my family, you'd be like this and et cetera, which I've done at points. But the reality is everyone down to now has done the best they could do with what they was given.
Exactly.
Or their environment. And actually, it's kind of a blessing. I feel blessed sometimes that, all right, maybe I had a tough enough time to go, I need to change something big time here because I'm probably not going to last too long. Wasn't great at the time, but the journey that I've embarked on after, and many people, sounds like yourself as well, you get to do all that work in a good way to rebuild yourself how you want to be. And sure, I know we talk about like, oh, if you had my brain, you'd be all over the place. But actually, look, like you said, you regulated yourself before you got here.
Mm.
We're having a great conversation. It doesn't mean you're immune to anything, but you have the ability to be hyper anxious and super aware or really calm.
Mm.
And I think displayed in your work as a doula, when probably people want to hang off the ceiling and there's blood and there's sick or whatever all over the place, and you can be completely calm, help the husband, partner, help the lady, is incredible. And I feel that that's the gift, that we can be in those environments when things are really, could be crazy, and be really calm.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because when, you know, most of the time, you know, births kind of go okay, there's not anything hugely dramatic apart from perhaps, you know, the feelings of the person going through it. But when there is like a big dramatic, you know, a crisis, for example, I am super calm. I'm super calm. You know, I'm more anxious about my parking today here than I am about that situation. I'm like, I can support you. I can be present. I can support your husband. I can be the voice of reason and calm. You know, I'm probably going to go home later and have a shake and a cry and have to write a stream of consciousness about it and do a salt bath and like just let go of it a bit, because I can really, I can naturally absorb some of that stuff. But yeah, it's a gift, really. You know, you got to use your gifts where you can, you know.
But that's the thing, I think it's a gift. We had David Smallwood on here who runs North London Priory. Yeah, he's great. Yeah. And he was saying addiction can be a gift.
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think half of the stuff that's happened in my life, so it's all in different sections. So I think there was the, you know, the pre-recovery section. Then there was my first decade of recovery. Then the second decade of recovery was having my son, who, as you know, has got, you know, very complex disabilities and all that that's brought. You know, I think most of the time now I can look on all of these things as they are not things that I would have chosen, you know, but they are gifts. They really are. Like all of this stuff is pushing me, you, whoever, to where you need to be next. And I'm not saying, oh, you know, everything happens for a reason, but something can come out of everything, you know. And it's often those people that have had the most challenges and managed to kind of prevail and come through it. It's such a profound gift, you know. That doesn't mean that there aren't many, many, many days where I'm like, fuck, it's so hard, you know, suffering and mental health stuff and, you know, pain and fear about my son. Like, it's fucking hard. And it's okay that it's hard, you know. Even though it's hard, I can still, you know, love and accept myself. I can do the things that I need to do to take care of myself and my son. You know, I can make sure that I'm doing enough self-care, whether that's my body, my mind, my spirit, you know, connecting with people. And the most important one, I've really gone off on a tangent here, but the most important one, I think, being connecting with people and asking for help. You know, it's taken me many, many years in recovery to do that. You know, I was just like, I don't fucking ask for help. I don't call people, right? You call me, I'll pick up the phone and I'll listen to you and help you, right? But that's not something I did until maybe 4 years ago, 3-4 years ago.
Well, it's hard to be the vulnerable one.
Yeah,